first to look ahead to this time next Tuesday.
On BBC Radio 4, it's the show that asks comedians to live in an audio-only world.
How many kids is this?
7.
It's 2!
With guests including Susie Ruffle, Donna Preston and Lee Mack.
Lee! Is this a baby or a goat? Goat! It's a baby! All right, kid!
Why? Well, I devised this show because I'm blind and this is what I have to put up with, so let's see how they cope with it.
It sounded like it has an airbag.
In what way did it sound like it had an airbag?
Well, in my brain.
You heard it here first with me, Chris McCausland. Next Tuesday evening, 6:30, comedy on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
Now on Radio 4, stories with an edge as we spend another half an hour in the company of the American raconteur.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet David Sedaris.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. This is an essay called My Corona. When the coronavirus first came onto my radar early in 2020, I wanted nothing more than to get it. Then I listened to a lengthy podcast on how gruesome it was and decided that instead, I wanted Hugh to get it. Not to die, of course, or even to suffer all that much. I just wanted close proximity to what then seemed like a pretty exciting story. When New York was hit, I figured that one of us was a shoo-in, but nothing doing. That first year and a half, I was incredibly reckless. Of course, I wore my mask and kept my distance at the grocery store, just like they told me to. But throughout the worst of it, Hugh and I had dinner parties 2, sometimes 3 times a week. Anyone was welcome. Though we had some close calls, the virus didn't get me until the late spring of 2022. I just finished a 44-city lecture tour and had a week off before my new book came out, at which point I would go to 40 more cities. Timing-wise, it was perfect, like I'd scheduled it. The funny thing was that I never felt particularly sick. My throat was scratchy, I ached a bit, but I could still smell and taste. Seasonal allergies, I figured my problem was. I'd have carried on as usual had I not taken a COVID test required for a late-night chat show I was scheduled to appear on. When the results came back positive, I was shocked. For years, I'd been hearing about how brutal this virus was. If I hadn't been vaccinated and taken a booster shot, it maybe would have knocked me for a loop. But compared to even a bad cold, this was nothing. I immediately gave it to Hugh, of course. I had to for the sake of our reputation. We'd all heard stories in which, say, a wife would get the coronavirus but her husband wouldn't, and I'd think, what kind of a couple are you? Giving Hugh my COVID told the world that we were on the right track, intimacy-wise. He didn't get terribly sick either, but still we had to quarantine and stop having people over. My test had been administered at my publisher's office, professionally, by a nurse. Before heading home, where I'd later get the results, I stopped by to see my publicist and came upon a mountain of mail. It had once been a stack upon a desk, but then it grew and spilled over onto the floor, a mudslide of boxes and envelopes, all of it addressed to me. I carried part of it back to my apartment and had the rest delivered. 185 people had written, and during my week of quarantine, I answered them all, or almost. When someone is angered or offended now, they always swear that they are never going to read anything you write ever again. They're going to tell all their friends not to read you either, even for free from the library. Meanwhile, they've taken the books they already owned and thrown them in the garbage can, which stunk before but stinks even worse now because it has something you made in it. Stinker. It's a scorched earth policy that leaves no room for dialogue or forgiveness. So why bother to write these people back? I did make one exception, though. A man had written from California concerning a line in a book of diary entries I had released. In it, my sister Gretchen and I were having a conversation, and as we spoke, she tore the legs off a cricket and threw it to her Chinese box turtle, Mrs. Chin. I'd written about this turtle once before, 10 years earlier, when raccoons crept into her pen and ate both her front legs, chewed them right down to the nubs. Mrs. Chin survived, but understandably isn't as spry as she once was. That's why Gretchen did what she did to the cricket, to slow it down and make it easier to catch. They say to use scissors, but my way's just as good, I quote her as saying in the diary entry. The angry reader was not having it. I bet you'd really get some chuckles ripping the wings off butterflies, he wrote. After all, insects feel no pain, right? I wanted to say that I hadn't done anything. It was Gretchen. And she hadn't torn the cricket's legs off out of boredom. Within 20 seconds, it would be eaten by a turtle. A disabled one. Who's Asian? And didn't Mrs. Chin deserve to live as well? As had the other angry letter writers, this guy said that he was through with me, finished. The next letter I opened was from a woman in Canada who'd sent me a list of toilet models her plumbing contractor had recently provided her with. The names were assigned by the manufacturer and included the Cadet, the Town Square, the Laura, and Memoir. What an odd job that must be, naming toilets. I could see that if one flushed super quietly, you might call it, I don't know, the Phantom or something, but the Laura? Memoir? I tried to think of what the town square might look like, but kept returning to the man from California. When answering people, I most often send postcards. I have stacks that I've collected over the years, and all of them are pretty decent, in my opinion. The one I wrote the guy back on was a black and white photograph of an Eskimo who had been horribly mauled by a bear. The man was smiling and smoking a pipe, but his face was an absolute mess. It looked like the flesh on it had been quilted and crudely, possibly by someone who had never sewn before and used yarn rather than surgical thread. Poor guy's eyes were off kilter as well. The bridge of his nose was gone, leaving only the gnarly little tip. I wrote the Californian that no matter what, he should never read anything by Eudora Welty. Once she went fishing with her father, and he put a worm on a hook, I said. It was writhing, obviously in pain. And what did she, his only daughter, do to stop it? Nothing. I don't know that this actually happened. I just wanted to point out how ridiculous this crab from California was being. I mean, what was I supposed to do? Snatch the cricket out of Gretchen's hands and reattach its legs? Cut off all contact with her in protest? Another letter I received took me to task for referring to our former president as Trump during a radio interview. This as opposed to our 45th president, Donald J. Trump, which the fellow said was more respectful. But come on, people say Kennedy and Bush and Obama with no implied derision. It's not unheard of. The man signed off with, "A response is requested." I never write people back when they tell me to. Answering you will be my idea, not yours, thank you very much. High school students often end their letters with, "I look forward to your reply," and that drives me just as crazy. I have to respond to these people, they're kids. But I always tell them that theirs was a shitty way to sign off. And that if it was their teacher's idea, he or she needs a lesson in manners. Letters from strangers are like landmines. You never know which one is going to blow you to bits. And so in time, I started pulling them from their envelopes very slowly and squinting at a random clot of words, trying to ascertain whether it sounded angry or not. I should have thicker skin by now. There's no way to please everyone. It's impossible. So why take it so hard when someone gets mad at me? I know people who go on social media and actively engage their critics. I'm human garbage. No, you are. But I hate conflict, even if it's just one-sided. A lot of my mail comes from prisoners. Word gets out that you write convicts back, and suddenly you're inundated. One guy wrote from a federal facility in Ohio and asked me to endorse a book he had written. I responded that I get an average of 30 such requests a year, so was taking a break from what's known in my world as blurbing. I was polite and had forgotten all about it when, around 6 months later, I got a second letter from this same person. Taped to an otherwise blank sheet of paper was my blurb for a novel that had just been released. And below that, the guy had written simply, WTF. The letters so deep and angry, they might as well have been carved. As I said to Hugh, good thing it's a life sentence. Finish one letter, move on to the next. How do people stay indoors day after day, I'd wonder, as my quarantine went on, walking into the den with another stack of mail and thinking again of the prisoners I hear from, thinking of my dad's last years locked away in his assisted living center. While under house arrest, I tried to mix things up, to write in places I hadn't written in before. Look, I'm at the kitchen counter. Now I'm in Hugh's studio, the dining room. Hoping the virus might cause me to lose a few pounds, I started every morning by standing on the bathroom scale, taking care to first undress, and even take out my night guard, as if that could possibly move the needle any. Rather than losing weight, I gained it, as what was there to do but snack and watch a Netflix show called Indian Matchmaking. Every episode starts with a couple whose marriage was arranged and who wouldn't have it any other way. We spoke for 10 minutes before the wedding, and that was enough. A content-looking husband or wife will say, "Now, here we are, 40 years later." The show's matchmaker, Seema Auntie, most people call her, is nearing 60 and dyes her straight, shoulder-length hair a color between light brown and red. Her face is cat-like, and on it, you can read her thoughts. The woman has little patience for clients with long lists of necessary characteristics, those who insist that their future partner be a certain height or work in a specific field. Many of the American-born Indians on the show want a man with a top knot, love men with top knots, but at the same time want them to be doctors. Seema Auntie has a number of smiles, each subtly different, and I especially like the one that amounts to an eye roll. Given the right foundation, you can grow to love anyone, is her philosophy. All that really matters is that the other person is decent. I can see how her approach might put someone off, especially someone in their 20s or 30s who looks around and thinks, can't we start with the top knot and the cardiology practice and worry about the decent part later? The matchmaker knows that none of that lasts. When the hair falls out and the hands start to tremble, what you're left with is character. Hugh is the only hard evidence I have that my detractors aren't right, that I'm not a completely horrible person. If I were, he wouldn't have gotten together with me, much less stayed with me for the past 33 years. Upstanding is a word people frequently use to describe him. Dependable, honest to a fault. Like a Boy Scout, but with extra badges for cheese making and rule following. And so, on the fifth day of quarantine, I didn't dare tell him that I was going out into the world. But you can't, he'd have wailed. The week isn't up yet. In my defense, I took the stairs, not the elevator, and wore two masks until I came to Central Park, where I kept my distance from other people. With me was some mail I thought I might answer. One of the letters expressed anger over a remark I had made on stage a month earlier. An ageist, sexist remark, according to the author. I remembered delivering it after I'd finished reading a short piece about a volunteer job I had at a state psychiatric hospital when I was 15 years old. On my first day there, I was sent into a locked ward where an orderly and I strapped a naked 80-year-old woman to a trolley. After reading the essay, I remarked that, in my opinion, gay people are born gay. That said, I added, if you have a son and want to sort of steer him in that direction, you might make certain that the first vagina he sees is on an 80-year-old woman and has 15 white hairs on it. I'm guessing the woman who wrote the angry letter also a Californian for what it's worth was an octogenarian as well. How would you feel if I turned that around, she demanded. What if I said, if you want to make your daughter a lesbian, show her the shriveled up penis of an 80-year-old man. Fine, I thought. Lower it to 60 even. I have no problem with that. No teenager wants to see the genitals of anyone old enough to know what statins are. That's just a fact, and calling it ageist isn't going to change anything. Were I trapped in my apartment, the woman's letter might have gnawed at me, but I was out of my cage now. Sitting in the sunshine on my Central Park bench, I recalled my first visit to New York City. I was 14, with all of a 14-year-old's terrible myopia and self-absorption. My godfather, whom we'd flown up from Raleigh to visit, drove my dad and me from his home on Long Island to Times Square, where I saw more people in 3 minutes than I'd seen in my entire lifetime. It was exhilarating, but also deeply distressing. Nobody here even knows that I exist, I thought, looking out the car window at the great passing throngs. They don't even know that North Carolina exists, most likely. My overwhelming problems, petty fights with my friends, the gayness I was hiding, they all amounted to nothing. I was nobody, a speck. 50 years later, and once again, the city was doing its job. A really excellent jazz trio was playing at the intersection of two paths not far away. Three young women walked by, one with a touch of green in her hair. A child of around 8 told her mother that she was not going to any party that Sierra went to. Then came a man who seemed to be talking to himself, but was evidently on his phone, and another man after him. Then a woman wearing a knee-length skirt with moccasins. In the distance, I heard horns and sirens, an ambulance, a police car, someone shouting for Philip. Each passerby diluted the importance of the angry woman from California, and diluted my own importance as well, until, after a minute or two, both she and I were nothing. This is an essay that I wrote that's in my last book, and it was in The New Yorker as well, and it's called A Better Place. Doesn't all our greatest art address the subject of death, its cruelty, its inevitability, the shadow it casts on our all too brief lives? What does it all mean, we ask ourselves? Allow me to tell you. Death means that the dinner reservation you made for a party of 7 needs to be up to 10, then lowered again to 9, and then up, this time to 14. 18 will ultimately show up, so you will have to sit at a foretop on the other side of the room with people you just vaguely remember, listening as the fun table, the one with your sparkling sister at it, laughs and laughs. You, meanwhile, have to hear things like, well, I know that your father did his best. People love saying this when a parent dies. It's the first thing they reach for. A man can beat his wife with car antennas, can trade his children for dogs or motorcycles, but still, when he finally, mercifully dies, his survivors will have to hear from some know-nothing at the post-funeral dinner that he did his best. This, I guess, is based on the premise that we all give 110% all the time. Regarding everything, our careers, our relationships, the attention we pay to our appearance, etc. Look around, I want to say. Very few people are actually doing the best that they can. That's why they get fired from their jobs. That's why they get arrested and divorced. It's why their teeth fall out. Do you think the chef responsible for this waterlogged spanakopita is giving it his all? Is sitting across from me spouting cliches and platitudes honestly the best that you can do? Also, don't use the word past at this table, unless it's as in Tula passed me the salt so I could flavor my tasteless tzatziki sauce. Or I knew we were driving too slowly on our way to the funeral when the hearse passed us and the man driving it gave me the finger. My father did not pass, neither did he depart. He died. Why the euphemisms? Who are they helping? I remember hearing a woman on the radio a few years back reflecting on where she was the moment that Prince, the musician, transitioned. Really, I thought, and when exactly did he become a woman? Days before his fatal drug overdose? Also, can we give the whole looking down from heaven bit a rest? This as in, I'm sure your mother is looking down right now at you and your family. Sure about that, are you? Sure, there's a heaven right above the cloud cover, one that no satellite or spacecraft has ever picked up on, and that my long dead mother can peer down from it and spot my brother, my sisters, and me indoors. Some of us with hats on. Out of the roughly 8 billion other people on Earth and without her glasses. Because they weren't with her in the box she was burned to ashes in. Because if that were possible, she wouldn't be thinking, I'm so proud of my son, but what's he listening to that asshole for? As for my father, if anything, he's looking up at me, not down. He was 98, a blessing, you keep saying. He must have been a wonderful man to have been rewarded with such a long life, as if it worked that way. And extra years were tacked on for good behavior. Any number of decent people die young. You know who's living a good long life? Dick Cheney. Henry Kissinger, Rupert Murdoch. He'll always be with you is another tiresome chestnut I'd be happy never to hear again. In response to it, I say, what if I don't want him with me? What if 64 years of constant criticism and belittlement were enough? And I'm actually fine with my father and me going our separate ways, him in a cooler at the funeral home and me here at the kids' table. He won't be in his grave for another few days. Is that the better place you've been assuring me he's headed to? The cemetery we pass on our way to the airport? The plot with the view of the Roy Rogers parking lot? And what exactly is it better than? This restaurant, clearly, but what else? This state, this country, this earth? No offense, but how can you be so sure of his whereabouts? You didn't even know where the men's room was until I told you. So why should I suddenly believe that you're omniscient? The best you can say with any degree of certainty is that my father's in another place, meaning not the only restaurant in town that could accommodate a party of 18 with 5 hours notice, which, hint, it could only do because nobody else wants to eat here. Especially me. It's just that I need to keep my strength up. Because I'm grieving. I was just going to close today by reading a few things from my diary. I started keeping a diary when I was 20, and now I'm 65. August 11th, 2021, Rackham, West Sussex. I just left the supermarket in Storrington late yesterday afternoon and was passing the ATM when a beautiful young woman stopped me. "Excuse me, sir, but do you think you could help me?" I thought it was a scam of some sort. "Due to my long nails, I can't always grab my card when the machine spits it back out. So do you think maybe you could do that for me?" "Of course," I said, delighted. What an odd problem to have. And completely self-inflicted. February 10th, 2012, Paris. Hugh and I took the 2 o'clock train from London. Our car was crowded. And off and on throughout the trip, I'd tune in to the women across the aisle from us. The younger one was French, and her seatmate, who looked to be in her late 50s, was English. "My son is in Paris," she told the younger woman, "so I'm going to see him for the long weekend." Her French was pretty good, but every now and then she'd slip up. "He works as a mushroom for British writers," she said. "I beg your pardon?" the French woman asked. "A mushroom," the woman repeated. "My son is a mushroom for writers." "I see," the French woman eventually said. January 27th, 2018, Tokyo. On our way to the pottery shop we liked yesterday, we passed an antique store we visited on our second trip to Tokyo back in 2007. "I bought a globe here," Hugh said to Amy, pausing to look in the window. It was smaller than usual and on a beautiful stand. We shipped it back to England before leaving, but for some reason or other, it never arrived. He frowned, and I put my hand on his shoulder. Poor Hugh. That globe meant the world to him. November 30th, 2022. New York. There was an actor on the plane I took from Seattle to New York the other day, maybe 50, bearded, handsome. And I drove myself crazy wondering where I had seen him, what movie or TV show. Had he been in uniform, I wondered? Played a cop, a soldier? I talked about it with my sister Amy when we went shopping yesterday. I wanted to ask the guy, "Where do I know you from?" I said. Though, of course, it's not his job to know what I've watched and haven't watched. Amy, who has been in countless movies and TV shows herself, gets that question all the time. People ask, "Where do I know you from?" And then we say, "Do you watch a lot of porn?" Thank you.
Meet David Sedaris was written and read by David Sedaris. The producer was Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for the BBC.
And David will be back at the same time next week.
Drama on BBC Radio 4.
Aldrich Kemp is dead.
If only things were that straightforward. The investigation doesn't stop there. As Clara Page's new boss, I'm putting her back on the case on the streets of London.
Follow that cab!
You're joking, Angela.
Call me love again and see how funny I am.
And in some rather more exotic locations.
We are literally in the middle of a jungle. Ow!
From the creators of the Lovecraft Investigations.
Who killed Aldrich Kemp?
That is the piece of the puzzle which we don't yet have.
Starts tomorrow afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.